So I'm passionate about getting this done because I know it will ensure workers in our state and across the country can join together to demand their fair share of the economic growth that they drive.
And
See, I view our government as not just things that do for us. I see it as the instrument that we use collectively to do the things that we can't do individually.
We've lost probably about 1,800 students each school year to the family empowerment. We're going to get to a point where we reach saturation. And when that happens, what's going to happen? There's money to be had, so you're going to have schools pop up on corners.
Plants are always going to close. And if you don't try to stay on the upbeat with organizing, we would have been down by 531 members. That would have been 25% of our local.
Welcome to the Labour Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from some of the more than 100 shows that make up the Labour Radio Podcast Network. On today's show, Senator Patty Murray dialed in to Working to Live in Southwest Washington to discuss the Protecting the Right to Organize Act with Harold and Shannon. Jesse Lee from the Center for American Progress joined Rick Smith to offer his verdict on Joe Biden's first 100 days in office. Then, what is the impact of taxpayer-funded vouchers that allow parents to remove their children from public schools and send them to private schools upon educational equity? It's a question we all ask ourselves at some point. As Governor Ron DeSantis signed into law legislation that will massively expand the voucher system in Florida, Angie Gallo from the Orange County School Board and Adora Obi-Nwezi, president of the Florida Conference of the NAACP, joined Tina and Luke on Educating from the Heart to sound the alarm and explain the real implications of this measure. In this week's episode of the BCTGM Voices Project, Hank Mackay, president of Local 6 in Philadelphia, explains how he insulated his union from a 531-member loss and came out with a net gain of 370 additional members. Why did Michael Green, an unemployed worker previously in the event services industry in Maryland, suddenly discover in February that his unemployment benefits had been frozen? Chris Bangett Drowns investigated what's going on at the Maryland Department of Labor. And finally, we traveled to downtown Fort Wayne, Indiana, and joined the Philharmonic Orchestra's May Day rally, where musicians, locked out and unpaid, explained why it's finally time to get the band back together. We've got reports from Working to Live in Southwest Washington, The Rick Smith Show, Educating from the Heart, the BCTGM Voices Project, Monday Morning QB, and My Labour Radio. I'm Patrick Dixon for the Labour Radio Podcast Weekly. Here's the show.
Hello, working people of Southwest Washington.
You're listening to episode 17 of Working to Live in Southwest Washington, produced by the Southwest Washington Central Labour Council. We're also a proud member of the Labour Radio Podcast Network, with over 100 radio shows and podcasts for working people just like you. Find out more about the network at laborradionetwork.org.
I'm Shannon Myers.
And I'm Harold Phillips.
We have something huge happening around the United States, and it's called the PRO Act.
The Protecting the Right to Organize Act, which is so exciting because it's the first major piece of labor law reform in what, 100 years, something like that?
100 years.
We've got somebody with us today who knows all about the PRO Act because she helped write it, Washington's own Senator Patty Murray. Thank you so much for making the time to join us, Senator.
It is really great to hear your voices and to be on with you today.
Well, you know, Senator Murray, I was looking at this postcard on my wall above my computer, and it's a thank you card from you. And I can't remember how many years ago it was, but you've been working on this PRO Act deal for a long time, and you had a sit down with me and labor leaders from Southwest Washington to talk about what should be in this PRO Act, and you took it back to Washington, and now here we are. So why did you feel so impassioned to write and run with this PRO Act?
Oh, Shannon, I think that was about 4 years ago, and I am impassioned to write and run with this because not only from where we were then, but now the pandemic has really made clear what workers have known for a really long time, that our economy is benefiting the biggest corporations and the wealthiest individuals, And it's really failing workers, and in particular, women and workers of color. We know that wages haven't budged for the bottom 50% of the workers, and the top 1% of earners have seen their wages grow by 205%. So we can't ignore this worsening income inequality and the deep impact it has on women, workers of color, people who disproportionately have jobs with lower wages and fewer benefits. And we know that unions are a critical part of how we can work to increase wages and address growing income inequality, because we know actually that union members earn on average 19% more than those in a non-union workplace. So the PRO Act that we talked about 4 years ago, and I'm still working to pass, would reverse years of attacks on unions and restore fairness to this economy. So I'm passionate about getting this done because I know it will ensure workers in our state and across the country can join together to demand their fair share of the economic growth that they drive.
And speaking about being a worker, you used to be a teacher, didn't you? The teacher in tennis shoes, a union member as well?
Preschool teacher, member of AFT, yes.
Senator, you've just outlined some of the problems that the PRO Act aims to fix. Can you give us some examples of what's in the act and how it's going to deal with income inequality, the gender pay gap, and some of the other issues you mentioned?
What the PRO Act does is it restores fairness to the economy by actually strengthening the federal laws that protect workers' rights to act collectively and to bargain for higher wages and benefits. And protecting the right to join a union is really critical, as I said, to reversing the imbalance in our economy. And the PRO Act does that by strengthening the remedies and punishing violations of workers' rights, strengthening workers' rights to stand together and negotiate for better working conditions, and really restoring fairness to this economy that's so important in bringing transparency so workers can join together and know they have the protection of federal law to be able to fight to join a union and be able to bargain for better workplace policies.
Now, Senator, we just had a big election in Bessemer, Alabama, at the Amazon facility there. Would the PRO Act have made a difference, do you think, in the way that election might have come out?
Well, I believe that all workers should have access to free, fair, and safe union elections, which is exactly why I believe the Senate needs to pass the PRO Act to protect workers' rights. And we have to fix the flawed system so there aren't questions about how unions are organized or whether they are fair.
You know, Senator Murray, you visit us quite often here in Southwest Washington, and we appreciate that because you understand that you represent the whole state. I don't want to bring up the past, but I know that what happened on January 6th at the Capitol, it really had all of us worried, you know, not only for our democracy, but for you personally. And so Harold and I just wanted to make sure that you were okay and hope that you are doing well.
Oh, Shannon, thank you for asking. I'm doing fine. And what happened on January 6th is our democracy was threatened. And we need to hold everybody accountable for what happened that day, because we have to protect our votes and our voices and our ability to speak out. And we can never allow it to be overtaken by brute force, which is exactly what people tried to do on that terrible day of January 6th. So we cannot act out of fear. We need to act out of strength. We need to stand up and speak out against it. And that's what keeps me going.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Senator Murray. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. And hello to all of you. I can't wait till we get over all of this pandemic and we can see each other in person and give each other hugs. And as I say, not just return to normal, because normal wasn't good enough. Return our country to a better normal as a result of what we have learned from this pandemic.
Oh, Senator Patty Murray, you represent us well. We love you. Thank you.
Call your friends and family in Arizona, in Virginia, even in my old home state of Alaska, and tell them to tell their senators to support the PRO Act so that you can feel like you're not alone at work. We'll see you soon.
Bye.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So here we are, 100 days into the Biden administration, and the big speech last night I'm looking forward to the discussions and the debates moving forward. I'm here to share some thoughts on the first 100 days, maybe a little bit about the big speech. I've asked Jesse Lee to come talk with us. Jesse's the Vice President of Communications there at the Center for American Progress Action Fund, AmericanProgress.org, their website. Check them out on Twitter, Cap Action. Jesse, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So let's start with the big speech last night. Great thoughts. What did you think last night?
Sure. So, I kind of pivoting off your kind of intro there, I worked in the Obama administration for 8 years, and I didn't interact with Biden that much directly. But when I did, it was kind of for some intensive periods. And, he said stuff to me that makes what he's doing now less surprising to me. He had more of a fighting instinct than I think a lot of people knew about him. And I think that's kind of come through. I think he realized that the middle class of working people have been left behind for decades. And if he seizes the moment, he can rectify a lot of what's been wrong with the country and the economy for all these years. Yep. And I think, the agenda he laid out in that speech last night was, that's what you do. You're talking about an economy that produces millions of jobs and huge kind of what I would describe as kind of progressive economic growth. And that's economic growth that doesn't just benefit, the stock market and CEOs, but benefits everybody. And that's what we haven't seen in this country, right?
Absolutely.
And I think, it's funny, when I started thinking about this a month or two ago, I kind of recoiled from the idea of, well, we shouldn't talk about economic growth. That's like a Republican thing, right? And that's a problem that I think we as progressives think that way. It's a problem that the country thinks that way. And you see this in polling. People will say the Democrats are looking out for people like me, but Republicans are better on the economy in some abstract term, or economic growth as some abstract way. And I think Biden's got a unique opportunity here to kind of seize both of those mantles and say, actually, we could do both.
No, I'm right there with you. And this is where I think Biden last night did a great job laying out his vision for what this next infrastructure bill and what the future of the economy looks like. Some of my left friends who were freaked out when he won South Carolina and he wasn't going to be viewed as progressive as Bernie or Elizabeth or any of the other ones. I said, look, he's a labor guy. This is who he is. I think he's resetting the Democratic Party to where they were when he was a young man. This isn't radical. This is where my grandparents' generation were. This is not radical talk that he's doing. This is what two generations ago the Democratic Party stood for.
Yeah, a lot of these proposals were on the table 2, 3, 4 decades ago. Universal child care was on the table back then. And, there was a big setback around Reagan, I think, a shell shock that, I think was partly the result of successful kind of mythologizing from Republicans, right? But, it shell shocked Democrats into reverting and the whole the era of big government is over, blah, blah, blah. And now, I'm reading the tip sheets and, Politico and whatever. Well, the era of big government is back. It's like, I don't know, man, is like that child tax credit giving people with kids a little more money so that they can get child care? Is that big government? I guess I if you say so, it's a tax credit. That doesn't sound dystopian to me.
No, we can debate the size of government. I have people, big government. Explain what big government is. It's subjective to me. I don't want big government. I don't want small government. I don't want medium-sized government. You know what I want? I want effective government. I want government that's going to make sure that things get done. I want the potholes filled. I want the bridges not collapsing. I want our kids getting good education. I want people to have health care. I want homeless people to find homes. And I want our government to be a hand in that. I view our government as not just things that do for us. I see it as the instrument that we use collectively to do the things that we can't do individually. So let me ask you last line of question, because, the next 100 days are obviously going to be the hardest one. They usually get a honeymoon. What do you see the next 100 days being?
I think there's a lot of discussion about this in the kind of progressive movement and Democratic Party, and I think even inside the White House. But my feeling is Biden needs to keep up the kind of tone that he had in that speech. And it needs to be about aspiration, where we can have a booming economy that works for everybody. And the kind of economy that's been rigged against you all these years, we can fix it. And this is how you do it. And you need to get these senators, all this discussion about how do you appeal to Joe Manchin and, Sinema and all this. But you appeal to them by saying, you can do something great. You can make life great for your constituents for decades. And, it doesn't have to be like, well, you got to vote for it because if you don't, then this thing happens. Like, do something great.
Jesse, I appreciate the time. Always great talking with you. Thanks so much for sharing your thoughts.
All right. It's always a pleasure.
Good stuff, Jesse Lee, the Vice President of Communications there at the Center for American Progress. Make sure you check out their website, AmericanProgress.org. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people, let's talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
You're listening to Educating from the Heart. Thank you for joining our lively conversations with teachers, support professionals, parents, and students as they share issues that matter most in our public schools. Here are your hosts, Tina Dunbar and Luke Flint.
It's said there are two things in life that are certain, and that's death and taxes. But I think we can add another item to the list, vouchers. You know, when the Florida legislature convenes its 60-day session, one of their main priorities every year is the expansion of private school vouchers. You know, those state-sponsored scholarships paid for with taxpayer dollars.
Ain't that the truth? The House and Senate have both passed legislation that will massively expand vouchers. A family of four with an income of $100,000 is now eligible to receive taxpayer funds to send their children to unregulated, unaccountable private and religious schools. We are one step closer to the ultimate goal, which is universal vouchers.
We'll explore the issue in the first part of our two-part series on private school vouchers.
We'll talk with Angie Gallo, an active and concerned parent, past president of the Florida PTA, and current Orange County School Board member. Along with her is Adora Obianwezi, president of the Florida Conference of the NAACP, who is especially concerned about Black and Brown students and how they are impacted when public schools have their funds drained for these private vouchers.
Your feelings on this voucher expansion being the most ambitious attempt to privatize public education?
There is an issue for us with the NAACP because we do not support private schools. One of the major problems we have, when we start talking choice, when we start talking vouchers, we also start talking desegregation and resegregation. And we are finding now that our schools are suffering because of the fact that we have the voucher systems and all of the other systems that exist that is, privatization and what it is doing to our schools, what it's doing to our children. And this fight is nowhere where it should be, because now you see it in our legislative sessions. And they're actually attempting to vote again once and for all to clean out public education. We cannot allow our schools and our country to be resegregated again. We cannot allow that. We must fight that.
Yes. Angie.
I'm concerned. I'm concerned about the students. I'm concerned about our teachers. I'm concerned about the welfare of our state. So, we're creating a system where we're setting up two parallel education systems. And we've fought this before. We won, right? 2012, they tried to remove the Blaine Amendment. And the voters overwhelmingly said, no, we need a separation of church and state. We have Bush versus Holmes that said, no, it's unconstitutional. You cannot take direct funds out of our general revenue and put it into private schools, private religious schools. You can't set up those two parallel systems, which we've already done. We did it the last couple of legislative cycles with our family empowerment scholarships, which now directly comes out of our FEFP or our general revenue. So they've already kind of teed the ball to say. And from that, I know in Orange County, we've lost probably about 1,800 students each school year to the family empowerment. We're going to get to a point where we reach saturation. And when that happens, what's going to happen? There's money to be had, so you're going to have schools pop up on corners. And so my biggest concern really is the accountability piece. It's a concern for our students. It's concerned for their welfare. It's making sure that they're receiving a quality uniform education, which is dictated by our Constitution. And there's no parameters in place. There's no accountability in statute that ensures that when a child goes to a private school, that they're learning the curriculum that they need to learn, that they're learning the foundation that they need to learn, and that they're going to be college and career ready. And that should be our goal. Our goal is to raise successful human beings that will contribute to the workforce and create a strong economy.
People who are able to do things or need to be doing things in our school district or for the school district, they're not doing it, because we certainly need much more money and opportunities for our school districts and for our children.
Adora, I think what you said earlier about resegregation is really important. And it's a part of the voucher story that I don't think gets the attention that it deserves. And when you mentioned that, I thought of an old video clip from Doug Tuthill, who is the president of Step Up for Students, right? Which is the largest voucher funding organization. And I'm not going to put words in his mouth. I'm going to just play. It's like a 30-second video clip. To set the stage, he was at a school choice conference in Washington State. And he was asked, how can, in this liberal place, how can they get their legislators to support private school vouchers? And I think his answer really says it all. So hopefully when I press play, you'll be able to hear his voice.
Start with a tax credit program. It also gives you a chance to build strong support amongst your corporations. And that's huge politically too. So if you have you got some incredible corporations in Washington, if you can create a scenario where they're comfortable, you know, where they really wrap themselves around low-income people, particularly low-income people of color, and that becomes the face of the program. It makes it easier for Amazon or Microsoft or some of the other folks out there, Starbucks, whomever, to come forward. And once you start getting the corporate community comfortable with it, you know, you're really going to put your liberal Democrats in a very difficult position.
Wrap your program around low-income people of color to put Democrats in a difficult position. Adora, what do you think of that?
Wow. If it had some truth ringing to it, it may be different, but that's not the way it works. Quite frankly, every dime that's taken to give to the voucher system, whatever its name it may be, it takes away the dollar away from the public school setting, and the very child you say you are helping has far less now.
Well, that's it for our show. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you again real soon. Until then, keep educating from the heart.
Welcome to the BCTGM Voices Project, a podcast highlighting the real people who make up our union, the bakery, confectionery, tobacco workers, and grain millers. I'm Michelle Ellis, Director of Digital Media. In this episode, we talked with officers and organizers with BCTGM Local 6 in Philadelphia about some really effective growth strategies they've implemented over the last 3 or 4 years since our last convention. The local union president, Hank McKay, opens us up with some thoughts about plant closures, which have led to the loss of over 530 members. Using the strategies discussed in this interview, they have been able to stay on the upbeat and come out today with a net gain of 300 members. Organizing Director John Price helped me get the full story.
I just want John and Hank to start with an overview of the organizing program. You had said around the last convention, you really dedicated yourselves to growing this program. So you guys take it away.
All right, so let me start out. I was talking with Hank. By the way, we're both out in Bridgeton, New Jersey, another successful organizing campaign where we brought in 90 new members from Danone. They make this silk milk. We just got done finishing their first contract, and we're actually at vacation meetings all day. And let me just start with that first contract before I get in with Hank. One of the things for all the local officers out there watching this too, or anyone who negotiates contracts, it begins there. If you're in negotiations, you want to do your best to negotiate some type of recognition agreement with the employer. You can't get a recognition agreement. You want to try to get a neutrality agreement where they'll remain neutral during any organizing campaign.
Over the last 5 years, Local 6 says from closures, we've lost over 531 members. And in the last 5 years, due to organizing, we've increased that to 425. So there was a deficit there of maybe 70 members that we were shy from what we had lost. So with the merger, we had merged with Tasty Cake recently, and that was roughly 400 members. So we've got a gain of 334 members. So with that being said, I've been listening to Johnny for years about this, and I took it to heart that plants are always going to close. And if you don't try to stay on the upbeat with organizing, we would have been down by 531 members. That would have been 25% of our local. At one time, Local 6, before my time, used to have roughly around 7,000 members. And now we're down to, I believe, like right under 3. But we've lost 50% over the past 20 years, I would say, roughly 25 years. In order to survive, you have to organize, because when you lose 531 people, if we wouldn't have organized, we're now at a net gain of, like I said, 334. So,
well, one of the things, there would be one less position, certainly at the local office. And of course, you lose that union membership and density. It hurts. Just a couple other examples throughout the international, Local 68, for every member they lost, they organized. So had they not organized, that local would not be around. We have a lot of one and two shop locals out there. They're only one and two shops away from not existing anymore. It's a perpetual thing. In order to stay alive, you have to organize. So with that, you say, all right, let's get serious about it. Let's start training everybody in our local that wants to be involved and are motivated to go out and organize and give them all the tools. And so first it comes down to targeting. Local 6 does a good job at that. And then the hardest part that most locals have is, how do I get a contact in that location? The bottom line is that saying, you got to give it away to keep it. That really rings strong in our union, because the reason we have the best collective bargaining agreements in the industries of bread and cake and biscuit and candy and now dairy is because of our union density. And unfortunately, in biscuit, I don't want to use the word crumbling, but we have to start stepping our game up. Because you have greedy companies like Mondelez Nabisco, where they, because of lousy trade agreements, they're down in Mexico, and we're losing good union jobs here in the United States because of their greed. Companies like Kellogg's, who went out and bought Keebler and then bought Sunshine. Back in the day, you had Nabisco, Keebler, Sunshine. They were the top three. And because of our union density, we would negotiate the best contract in Nabisco and then have Keebler do that. Then Sunshine does it. And then the independents. But because of the laws of the United States, I'd say almost antitrust laws too, where you got a company, Kellogg's, ends up with Keebler, then they buy Sunshine. So that's number two and number three. And then they eventually start consolidating the business between new technology or outsourcing it to non-union facilities. And that takes the union density away from us. So two things that Hank just spoke on. One, we got to give away to keep it, is because we have to share it with those co-packers and the non-union Petrich Farms and other companies in the biscuit industry. They should enjoy the wages, benefits, and working conditions our members enjoy and always have enjoyed. Then we bring those memorandums. That helps the members we have now, because that gives us the union density. And once again, that union density gives us the strength for good level support and the best contracts. There's absolutely no shortage of non-union facilities in our industry.
All right, guys. Thanks again for your time.
Thank you.
Soon.
Okay, take care, everyone.
Get out and organize.
Yes,
I am.
This is Monday Morning QB, May 3rd, 2021.
I'm Askia Muhammad. With vaccines rolling out and some states reopening, many Americans see a light at the end of the pandemic tunnel. But economic relief remains elusive for many thousands of people who have struggled with their state governments to receive the unemployment benefits they are due. Last fall, 6 months into the pandemic, the Century Foundation estimated just under half of all claims had been paid out. This spring, thousands of claims remain unpaid, and in some cases, the problem is growing. Chris Banger-Drowns has that story.
Maryland's Department of Labor announced on Facebook this weekend a seemingly innocuous change in how unemployment insurance, or UI, benefits are paid to workers. But the post, like many made in recent months, became flooded with scores of frustrated comments about frozen UI accounts and an unresponsive Department of Labor. People complained about going weeks and sometimes months with no benefits and no word from the state agency. Michael Green is one such frustrated UI claimant.
I was successfully receiving benefits until February the 2nd, 2021, at which point I went to use my debit card and it was closed. I was trying to do a transaction at a gas station and it was closed.
Like so many of the Facebook commenters, Green said he struggled to make contact with the Department of Labor to fix the issue.
I called them and it's really hard to get through to anybody there because they don't answer their telephone. You sit through a series of phone menu options and you get to the end of the message and it says that they're sorry, no one can come through the phone right now.
Green says he did eventually speak with someone, but that he has since spent weeks transmitting documents, waiting, calling, and being bounced back and forth between the Department of Labor and Bank of America, which had contracted with the state to provide UI through debit cards.
I'm on week 11 now of filing a claim, having the payment processed, and then having it rejected by the bank. And at $730 a week, that's over $8,000.
Green had been receiving benefits regularly since the beginning of the pandemic, when he lost work in the events services industry. The sudden loss of those benefits has been troubling.
I've exhausted my retirement annuity. That's gone. I've had to relocate to my family, so my family's basically helping me. Luckily, I have them. I feel for anybody who's going through this without family. You know, this is just, I deal with this every day. I try to make phone calls every day. I try to speak to people every day. I email people every day. And it's just a constant struggle.
Green's recent issues, like those highlighted in the Facebook comments and in recent reporting by local media outlets, seem to be tied to a recent crackdown by Maryland on purported UI fraud. A Department of Labor spokesperson told WMAR that, as of mid-April, the agency had uncovered over 680,000 instances of fraud, comprising 88% of the total number of claims flagged for fraud. That statistic suggests that over 90,000 claims could have been falsely flagged as fraudulent and then frozen. The spokesperson also said that it was policy to not give claimants notice that their account had been flagged, warning that, quote, fraudsters would be tipped off. The Department of Labor hasn't revealed how many accounts remain locked, but said in January that nearly 43,000 claims were paused pending further investigation. If the possibility of tens of thousands of frozen UI accounts seems outlandish, consider the scale of the ongoing economic recession. Over 6 million Americans filed UI claims in just 1 week of April last year, 10 times larger than the previous record set during the Great Recession. Benjamin Orr, founder, president, and CEO of the Maryland Center on Economic Policy, describes this record-busting scale on the local level.
During 2009, at the sort of height of the Great Recession, about 399,000 Marylanders filed initial unemployment claims. That was new claims for that entire year. In the first 6 weeks of the pandemic, there were 347,000 claims. So in just 6 weeks, we had almost as many claims as in the entire year of 2009. And so the scale and the rapidity with which that happened was really unprecedented.
The scale of the current crisis means unemployment benefits play a massive role in the state economy.
At the peak, almost 10% of all wages in Maryland were unemployment wages. And by comparison, at the peak of the Great Recession, that figure was about 1.5%.
So because a significant fraction of income in the state comes in the form of benefits, any administrative policy that prevents timely payment of benefits could have an unusually broad economic impact. Thanks to Benjamin Orr of the Maryland Center on Economic Policy, whose website is mdeconomy.org. And thanks to Michael Green for sharing his experiences and insights. Stay tuned for updates on this story in coming months. For Monday Morning QB, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns.
And now, here's your next episode of My Labor Radio.
How you doing, everybody? This is Mark, your host on My Labor Radio. Welcome to this edition where we specifically talk about the Philharmonic Players. They are members of the Fort Wayne Philharmonic Players Association, which is part of the American Federations of Musicians. They are Local 58 right here in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Now, they are currently furloughed. Now, that's the term that's being used. Really, they're locked out because they haven't been paid. So, the entire board of directors, the managing director, and the president of the board, all people you know in this community, have stopped paying them and are blaming the pandemic. So, for lack of a better term, union busting. That's what they're trying to do, is break the union and deliver some crazy stuff. We're going to get into a lot of details in this episode. You'll specifically hear from the May 1st Allen County Courthouse Green event they had. A bunch of people were there. It was a huge crowd. All right, folks, this is Mark, your host. Welcome back. We're going to talk about the lineup and the guest speakers for the May Day rally to restore music. This was held at the Courthouse Square in downtown Fort Wayne. We're going to get right to it. Campbell McDonald is one of the coordinators that put this together. He's the principal clarinet with the Fort Wayne Philharmonic, and he is also the chair of the Fort Wayne Philharmonic Players Association. He plays MC and host, and will do introductions for some of the speeches you're going to hear. So let's get right to it, because we've got a lot to pack into the rest of this hour. Up first is Campbell McDonald welcoming everyone to the event.
Fellow citizens, union sisters and brothers, neighbors, supporters from across the region, and guests from around the country. On behalf of the Fort Wayne Philharmonic Players Association and the Fort Wayne Musicians Association, American Federation of Musicians Local 58, I would like to extend a warm May Day welcome to you all. We have a number of guest speakers today. We'll be sharing what our orchestra means to our region and just what is at stake for our city. But first, I'd like to talk about some of our friends and neighbors. Members of our community, and I'm proud to call them my colleagues and my friends. And I'm speaking, of course, about musicians of the Fort Wayne Philharmonic. Our music sings forth to audiences at the Embassy Theater, at Purdue University Fort Wayne, at the Arts United Center, at churches and healthcare centers and residences, and at educational performances for thousands of elementary school students annually across 11 counties. And for over a year, our service to the community and our music has been silenced. Following the initial shutdown, our offer to take wage cuts to accommodate the pandemic in August of 2020 were met with demands by Philharmonic management to abandon a collective bargaining agreement that has been built over the course of decades. Throughout the Philharmonic's furlough of musicians, every proposal we have made offering temporary COVID-specific concessions has been met by Philharmonic leadership with demands for permanent cuts to musicians and wages. Amidst the furlough, the Philharmonic has presented performances by traveling artists, both online and in-person events, and have been the subject of a formal complaint issued by the National Labor Relations Board, citing unlawful negotiating tactics and regressive bargaining. Fort Wayne Philharmonic's most recent position outlines what can only be called a part-time employment model for musicians, of 28 weeks scheduled over a 52-week period. They seek a blank check for our time and want to pay us less along the way. This has not been presented as a temporary remedy to the uncertainty of the COVID period, but as a permanent model of reduced service going forward. In yesterday's Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette, an op-ed by Fort Wayne Mayor Tom Henry was published entitled "Momentum on City's Side Continues." In it, he details the numerous exciting projects underway in our city and the nearly $1 billion in downtown investment made over the last decade. He states, "We continue to be on a roll." In stark contrast to the mayor's statement, the Fort Wayne Philharmonic Management and Board of Directors, those tasked with the stewardship of our service to the community, believe that now is the time to cut our orchestra's budget to a size that is easier to run. Amidst unprecedented economic development in Fort Wayne and our region, that now is the time to reduce our modest salaries to poverty wages. And as the Fort Wayne Philharmonic lays claim to nearly $26 million in accumulated wealth and continues to pay its administration and conductors, they believe that now is the time to permanently cut our season going forward. I have a question for all of you here today. Is now the time to rob our community of the joy of music? We musicians agree. Now is the time for the Fort Wayne Philharmonic Management and Board of Directors to utilize its resources to put musicians to work with conditions of employment that preserve our orchestra's over 75-year legacy without permanent cuts. It is time to creatively present music to our audience and mirror the success of the many orchestras across our country that have forged ahead in the past year. Now is the time to bring live orchestral music performed right here in Northeast Indiana by your friends and neighbors back to the stages and schools, back to our ears, to our hearts, and to our community. Thank you very much.
Sadly, that's it for this edition of the Labour Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from just a few of the more than 100 Labour radio shows and podcasts that make up the Labour Radio Podcast Network. We've got links to all the network shows at labourradionetwork.org, including complete versions of the shows you heard today. And you can also find them by using the hashtag Labour Radio Pod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Labour Radio Podcast Weekly was edited by Chris Bangett Drowns, produced by Chris Garlock and myself, and our social media guru is Harold Phillips. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Labour Radio Net. Find out more on our website at labourradionetwork.org. For Labour Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Patrick Dixon. We hope you're able to join us next time. Cheerio.